Before we jump into the show, I wanted to let you know that tapesfromthedarkside.com is now up and running. And I also wanted to let you know, especially those of you who maybe have your own podcast or thinking of starting your own podcast, the tool I used is really awesome. They're not sponsoring the show or anything like that, but they've just been a pleasure to work with. I'd highly recommend them. It's called PodPage. I just signed up for their pro plan, and their support team is just excellent. So if you wanted to give them a try, just go to podpage.com and enter promo code DARKSIDE for $20 off any pro plan, monthly or yearly. That's promo code DARKSIDE.
Tapes from the Dark Side contains descriptions of violence and sexuality. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Season 3 of Tapes from the Dark Side. I'm your host, TZ. Where are we and how did we get here? In Episode 1, we listened to Don Spirit's now infamous 911 call and were introduced to the Spirit family.
Yes, ma'am. I just shot my daughter and shot all my grandkids. And when you get here, I'm going to shoot myself.
In Episode 2, we took an in-depth look at the day of the murders, the discovery of the bodies, and a drug called Spice.
You know when you go into an attic and you see little chunks of fiberglass sitting around? That's what it looked like. I take a huge rip. I looked over at my friend, and I looked at him as if he were simply a sack of meat that was emitting sound.
In our most recent episode, Episode 3, we examined Don Spirit's criminal history, which includes an incident from 2001 when Don Spirit shot and killed his 9-year-old son, Kyle, in a hunting accident. An incident for which he would spend 3 years in state prison. As we wrap up this story, we'll look at the remainder of Don Spirit's criminal history, including some of his most violent offenses to date. We'll also take a look at the Florida DCF, the Department of Children and Family Services, and their lengthy history with the Spirit family. Florida DCF had investigated 18 individual incidents involving the Spirit family over an 8-year period, from 2006 to 2014. Don Spirit was included in 6 of those reports and was the alleged perpetrator in 3. When combined with criminal history, propensity towards violence, known drug abuse, felony possession of a firearm, accidental death of his son, and ongoing mental health issues, we are faced with an uncomfortable yet pertinent question. Is there anything that could have been done by the state to prevent this tragedy? Let's go back to 16 days before the Spirit family massacre, back to September 2nd of 2014, when a report came in to the Gilchrist County Sheriff's Department that had the potential to alter the fate of the Spirit family.
We have confirmed that DCF was called to that home in Bell 2.5 weeks before Don Spirit murdered 7 family members.
The department got a hotline call saying Don Spirit's 6 grandchildren were in danger. On September 1st, an investigator met Sarah Spirit, talking with her about concerns about drug abuse, specifically K2 or Spice, and marijuana.
An unknown person made an anonymous call to the police hotline in Bell, Florida, to say they had seen both Sarah and Don smoking Spice in front of their children.
The report states that Spirit admitted testing positive for those substances and was arrested for violating her probation. When she was released from jail, she then moved in with her father, Don Spirit. Now, I'm working to get answers as to why they were allowed to move in with Don Spirit.
This DCF report lists Sarah and Don as the alleged perpetrators in the incident, and all 6 Spirit children, Caleb, Kylie, Jonathan, Destiny, Brandon, and Alana, are the alleged victims. 16 days later, every single person in that report would be dead. The DCF secretary serves as the de facto leader of the organization. And in the beginning of 2014, that person was Mike Carroll.
The interim secretary of Florida's Department of Children and Families, Mike Carroll.
DCF secretary, Mike Carroll.
The former secretary had stepped down abruptly amid public outrage. Outrage that was arguably well-deserved. The Miami Herald had just released the details of an extensive investigation into DCF. Their project, titled Innocence Lost, made a horrifying discovery that over a six-year period, 477 children whose families had in some way sought the services of DCF had died as a result of neglect or abuse. Furthermore, the department had purposely underreported these statistics to the Florida legislature, which led to funding cuts and further deaths. These dead children represent the most vulnerable of our population. Most of the over 400 deaths were children at the age 5 or younger, and 70% were under the age of 2. Mike Carroll was still serving as the DCF secretary when the Spirit Family Massacre occurred just a handful of months after the release of the Innocence Lost investigation. And it couldn't have come at a worse time for the DCF, who was in the midst of what was already a PR nightmare. And yet, it's impossible for those familiar with the Spirit case to keep from wondering whether or not anything could have been done to prevent these senseless killings. Mike had only taken the job 6 months prior, and so it would be disingenuous to place the blame solely at his feet. Though we can say that Mike led and authored the rapid response report that was released 2 weeks after the massacre per Florida state requirements.
It's a critical incident rapid response team report. It's 20 pages. It goes into a lot of detail.
This report took an in-depth look at exactly what occurred during the DCF's interaction with the family and what the organization's role in the tragedy was. There are parts of this report that, even after reading them dozens, maybe hundreds of times now, I still cannot wrap my head around. To quote from a portion of Mike Carroll's executive summary, "The events that unfolded in Belle, Florida on September 18, 2014 were an incredible tragedy that cuts to the heart of DCF's mission. The senseless murder of these innocent children and their mother is an extreme outlier. There is no evidence to suggest that anyone at any time could have known that Don Spirit was capable of the premeditated, intentional massacre of his 6 grandchildren, his daughter, and then himself." The report goes on to explain, among other things, why DCF was not at fault in this case. And while Mike cannot and should not be held solely responsible for the systematic failings of DCF in prior years, he can and should be held responsible for this misleading statement that continues the legacy of the DCF refusing to accept responsibility for its failings.
Well, today, DCF Secretary Mike Carroll and a team of experts hit the ground in Tampa to join us to find out why the foster care system is failing.
And everybody's changing employment constantly. It's just a turnover that shouldn't be happening.
When you have so many different agencies, DCF contracting with somebody who contracts with somebody else, potentially who contracts with somebody else, it's all diluted. And who do we really hold responsible?
Former foster child Hope Ostrey pleaded with Carroll to help kids.
You're not only our case managers, but you're basically our family.
Mr. Carroll, I'm not attacking you at all, sir, but it's happening under your watch. If Mr. Mark Douglas did not put this out, you would not be here. They weren't going to say anything. They did not call you, Mr. Carroll, and tell you, hey, boss, we have a problem. We need some help.
I, too, want to fix both short-term and long-term.
At the end of the day, if this group decides that the reason why it's happening is because Eckerd is mismanaging the program, will you fire them?
Well, I have no problem holding folks accountable.
Responsibility is best understood when broken down to its composite parts. Response-ability. Quite literally, the ability to respond. The evidence that we have already reviewed paints the picture of an unstable and violent man. A man who is addicted to the psychotropic drug known as Spice, a man suffering from unmedicated mental illness, a man who had been to jail multiple times on DUI charges and felonious firearm possession, and a man who had already once been involved in the accidental death of one of his own children. This is not accounting for the most recent and I think most violent events in Don Spirit's past. We know that DCF had the ability to respond, so the question is, why did they choose not to? Over the past months, I have been grappling with this question, trying to find a satisfactory answer. And that one sentence from Mike Carroll refuses to leave the echoes of my subconscious. There is no evidence to suggest that anyone at any time could have known that Don's spirit was capable of this premeditated and intentional massacre. Now, let's go back even further to February of 2013, 1.5 years before the massacre. DCF investigators wrote in their report that they witnessed progress in the living situation of Sarah and her then boyfriend, James Stewart. They had had 2 kids together, Destiny 4 and Brandon 3, plus the 3 kids from Sarah's last relationship. In approximately 1 year, Sarah would be pregnant with her 6th child, Alana. The parents were in a committed relationship, and according to their friends and neighbors, the love they had towards their children was obvious to anyone who knew them. Sarah had made measurable progress from her old dysfunctional pattern of drug abuse, arrest, and subsequent abandonment of her children with relatives. Though one area that was marked for improvement by DCF was Sarah's follow-through. DCF said they had made suggestions to improve her parenting skills and that these were often ignored. Though this was not a unique thing within DCF, and it's not entirely the fault of the DCF investigators. At that time, there was no mechanism within DCF to respond to parents who didn't adhere to their suggestions. There were no repercussions or consequences set by the state, so parents were free to take or disregard DCF's feedback as they pleased. Even so, a report written by a DCF social worker at the time seems to accurately capture the nature of the situation. Quote, "The family has a lot of strengths. The parents are in a long-term committed relationship, home was clean, items picked up, and both parents indicate a willingness to participate with services." So what went wrong? First, let me step back from this case and say that we have taken a fine-tooth comb to nearly every detail involving the Spirit family, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But it would be naive of us to suggest that this is analogous to how a DCF worker would be able to approach the same case. Firstly, we must admit we have the privilege of hindsight. Looking into the past, we'll always be able to see things that seem obvious now. Yet, as we all know, present reality is much more ambiguous. Additionally, the average DCF worker's caseload stands in stark contrast to my own. The average Florida DCF agent handles 18 families at any one time. I, on the other hand, cover only 1 case at a time, maybe 2 if I'm doing research in advance. The specific department that handled the Don Spirit case is part of a statewide network that handles over 200,000 allegations of abuse and neglect each year. That's over 500 reports per day, and if we divide it out, that means a new report of child abuse every 3 minutes around the clock 24/7. The voice you're about to hear is that of the Deputy Secretary of DCF, Pete Digrie. The deputy secretary basically serves as the second in command. So if the DCF secretary is the president of the organization, then the deputy secretary would be the vice president. He is speaking at a town hall meeting organized by the Miami Herald as part of the Innocent Lost Project. This entire video is fascinating, and we'll come back to it later.
Right now, today in Miami, the average CPI has 18 cases. But guess what? A whole bunch of them are new. So some of the new ones have 2 and some of the old timers have 30. And those 30s are families, and they probably have about 60 kids. So we've got people in this town tonight that are trying to keep up with the well-being of 60 children. It is humanly impossible. So the single most important thing that we've done is to adopt the governor's recommendations, which gets our child protective investigators on the whole to a caseload of 10 families, which is still too high. I'm telling you, in Los Angeles, it's 7.5. In New York, it's 5.
What kind of budget would it take to get to that kind of caseload here in the state of Florida?
The governor has proposed a $40 million effort to build CPIs.
I'd like to address something that Pete says there, that the Florida governor pledged a $40 million increase to funding the DCF, which at face value sounds like a good deal. That is, until you consider the same governor, when he first took office, cut DCF's funding by a number much larger than $40 million. The story of Governor Rick Scott is a tragedy in and of itself. Rick boasted about the $40 million increase, but when he took office back in 2011, he cut DCF's budget by $172 million and eliminated over 1,800 positions, which is about 14% of its personnel.
Governor Scott has proposed cutting the budget of the Department of Children and Families by $172 million and 1,800 positions. His appointed DCF secretary says in order to adequately care for children, the state will have to invest in improvements.
He's revamping, making sure that we're doing the things we need to do, at the same time understanding that we don't have extra money right now.
Well, it's going to cost extra money. 80 more people, extra training, extra programs.
I'm going to do the best I can to allocate the dollars where I believe that our biggest problem is. DCF is an area that I know we've got to take care of these kids. But what we've got to do is we've got to figure out how we can do a better job of taking care of them, but don't waste dollars.
Democrats in Washington are living in a fantasy land where debt doesn't matter, spending has no consequences, but the reality is that inflation does have consequences. Americans deserve to know the consequences of massive government spending, and they deserve leadership that will show some fiscal responsibility when it comes to their taxpayer dollars.
But is there any indication right now, early on, about what is the problem?
Well, Carol told everybody today that Hillsborough County brings in more kids at a higher rate than anywhere else in Florida. In fact, they have more kids in the system than anywhere, nearly 4,000. They're overwhelmed, and they don't have the funds to go with it.
During a press conference, Rick's new selection for secretary stated, "I believe in the protective power of prayer and hope." That was David Wilkins, who would later resign amid a scandal of his own involving, you guessed it, more dead children. In modern-day American politics, Republicans have repeatedly pushed for policies that promote what we sometimes refer to as austerity. These policies aim to aggressively reduce government budget deficits through spending cuts. On the surface, it appears that this would be a common-sense approach. Though in practice, economists contest the idea that austerity is effective. Here is Rick Scott himself in one of his campaign ads.
If Washington was a business, it would be going bankrupt. It would be bankrupt by now. They don't accomplish anything. They're not solving problems. My opinion, you ought to send business people up there to solve problems. Successful business people. I'm Rick Scott, and I approve this message.
This analogy that the government is like a business is often repeated by Republicans. On the surface, once again, this seems like a common sense and reasonable way to approach the subject. But when you put it to some level of scrutiny, the analogy quickly begins to fall apart. Let's consider that as of 2021, the United States technically carries $1.9 trillion of debt. And you'd have to go back to 1835 to find the last time in recorded history when the United States had a debt balance of zero. Now, imagine a company attempting to exist under the same set of circumstances. There is a defined limit to the amount of debt a private company can take on, and when that company defaults on their loans, they are forced to declare bankruptcy, their assets are seized and sold. Their credit is often destroyed in the process, and almost always, the company ceases to exist, at least for some period of time, but usually for good. Yet despite its massive debt load, the United States proves year after year to be one of the most economically prosperous nations on Earth. How is this the case? The short answer is because countries are not like companies, and they probably shouldn't be run like them. Most economic experts agree that the probability that the U.S. defaults on its debt repayment is zero, and that is for a simple reason. The United States government can print money, which of course comes with its own set of problems, one of those problems being inflation. Yet as the national debt has grown to astronomical levels, inflation since the year 1990 has remained constant at around 2.5% a year. This is not to suggest that we should completely disregard the national debt. Budgeting is an important tool, and it's partly why we should pay attention to politics, not just national politics, but state and local too, who we trust with our money, our neighborhoods, our lives, and our children's lives. Runaway inflation can indeed become a threat to any nation or state, especially one with a large debt load. But the answer cannot be to recklessly cut spending without a clear plan for mitigating risk. And since Rick Scott likes to use business analogies, he must know that you can't walk into a company, cut the personnel by 15%, cut funding for operations, increase workload, keep pay the same, and beyond that have no plan whatsoever. You'd be a fool to expect anything other than chaos and failure, which is exactly what ensued. As far as we know, Rick Scott never studied economics. He enlisted in the Navy for a couple of years, went to college on the GI Bill, and got a degree in law. He bought a couple donut shops with the financial help from his parents, and he was moving up in the world before Rick Scott found himself as the leader of the state of Florida. He had resigned a role as the chief executive officer of a healthcare company, which had defrauded Medicare and Medicaid. That company was ultimately fined $1.7 billion, which at the time made it the largest healthcare fraud case in the history of the United States. Rick was deposed in the year 2000 concerning his involvements in the company, during which he pled the Fifth Amendment 75 times.
I don't recall. I wouldn't know. Well, what do you mean by occupancy? I'm not sure what the definition is. Say the question again. What's your definition of overcapacity?
Rick claims to take responsibility for the fraud that occurred under his watch.
When you're a CEO of a company, if people make mistakes, you take responsibility. So anything that happened on my watch, I take responsibility for.
So whatever happens, you have to take responsibility. So in that case, the company paid Medicare fines. I take responsibility for the things that happened on my watch.
When I think of someone taking responsibility for a crime, what comes to mind is going to jail, paying a fine, or something of the sort. But in Rick's case, it was actually the opposite. Instead of paying a fine, he got paid, not to add a massive amount of money. He left with $300 million in stocks, a $5.1 million severance package, and a $950,000 per year consulting contract for 5 years.
So you learn big lessons in business, and that's the difference. In business, you put your money up, you do the best job you can every day, and if something goes wrong, you're held accountable. You pay the price.
This man won election to the governor's office of Florida, albeit by a very slim margin of less than 1% of the vote. And to put it bluntly, over the next 8 years, Rick Scott ran DCF into the ground. To give you an idea of where DCF was before Rick took office, the National Child Welfare Coalition said that Rick's predecessor had, quote, led the largest transformation of an American child welfare system in recent decades, turning Florida from the national example of failure into, relatively speaking, a leader in doing child welfare right. He took an organization that was just starting to get a grip on managing child abuse cases to the point that lives were actually being saved, and he shredded it. I know you're probably sick of me speaking about numbers right now. Being not much of a math person myself, I am too. But let me very briefly touch on the salary for a Florida CPI. The backbone of the DCF are its Child Protective Investigators, or CPIs. They meet with the families one-on-one, make the tough decisions over whether a home, parent, or living situation is safe, and they are the last line of defense for our most vulnerable, our children. It's hard to put a price tag on that. In 2013, an average annual CPI salary was a meager $32,000 a year, which is right around $15 an hour. It's better than minimum wage, but not by a whole lot. In comparison, the average hourly wage in America that year was $13 per hour. Not to put a value judgment on any particular job. All work is worth proper pay. But just for the sake of comparison, here are a handful of jobs that paid equal to or greater than the hourly wage of a CPI in the year 2013. Real estate agent, $28 an hour. Travel agent, $17 an hour. Bus driver, $15 an hour. Locksmith, $19 an hour. Secretary, $18 an hour. Tire builder, $19 an hour. Postal clerk, $23 an hour. Meter and utility reader, $18 an hour. Police dispatcher, $18 an hour. We will be right back and returning to the Spirit family after a quick break. Tapes from the Dark Side is a fully independent podcast that relies on the generosity of our listeners. If you want to join the band today and get free stickers, exclusive pin set, merch discounts, and a shout out at the end of the credits, then sign up today. Support the things you love. Just go to patreon.com/tapesfromthedarkside. It takes less than a minute to sign up, and our tiers start at $1 a month. I also want to tell you about the site I use for hosting my show. If you're a podcast creator and you're thinking about switching hosts, or maybe you're looking to start a podcast, my number one recommendation would be Pinecast. It's not as well known as the bigger podcasting hosts out there, but what they lack in size, they make up for in customer service and just excellent reliability. Their plans are also priced very competitively. I have been with a couple of hosting sites, and Pinecast is by far my favorite. Now, they're not sponsoring the show, but they have created a unique discount code for me to offer to you guys for what is really an excellent deal. It's 40% off any plan you choose for 4 months. And if you use my promo code, I also get a small credit. So you're helping the show at the same time. It's a win-win. Once again, the promo code is DARKSIDE. So just go to pinecast.com and at checkout, enter promo code DARKSIDE for 40% off 4 months. That's it. Let's get back to the show. In June of 2013, the deputy would write in a report to DCF details that should have sent up red flags for anyone familiar with Don Spirit's past. In this report, we learn that Sarah had explicitly told her mother that Don was keeping guns at his home again, and being a convicted felon living in Florida, Don had lost his Second Amendment privileges. A reality that he was well aware of, being that he spent 3 years in state prison for the incident that resulted in the death of his son. Would Don Spirit's dangerous history with firearms be enough for DCF to forbid any contact between Don and his grandchildren? In this same report, the deputy noted that Kylie, age 8 years old, had unusual bruises on her body. The siblings reported to the officer that Don Spirit would sometimes beat them with a belt. Furthermore, in this same report is a detail that might be the most tragic part of this case. The deputy discovered that Kylie, the same one with the bruises, was wetting the bed at night, and according to her parents and siblings, she would often try to hide these accidents by changing her underwear herself. The deputy said, quote, "Based on my training, this could be a sign of sexual abuse." According to statistics from the Department of Justice and the FBI, in a 2013 report, they found that 93% of juvenile victims knew their perpetrator and 34% were family members. If you'll remember earlier, we heard from Pete DeGree.
Is when there's a sexual abuse involved in the family, the odds of death go up by 67 times. I mean, absolutely incredible.
After making his report to DCF, the police officer said he was waiting for the agent to follow up with him about setting a date for a forensic interview with Kylie. But this date was never set. The incident was closed by DCF, and no further investigation took place. To this day, we don't know, and will never know, whether Kylie was being abused. In 2013, the University of Florida Child Protection Team, who was also involved in the Spirit case, recommended that based on their research and observations, Don Spirit should have no unsupervised contact with his grandchildren. This recommendation was ignored. Mike Carroll wrote in his report that DCF agents might have gotten too complacent after investigating 8 years of the same kind of cases involving the same family. Quote, "The level of familiarity played a role in ongoing assessments of the family. Staff thought they knew and understood the dynamic and child safety risks within this family, and their view of the family appeared not to change over time." Mike also wrote that the case warranted a 5-part plan to help prevent such a tragedy from occurring again. He said that DCF would retrain all their investigators that had handled the Spirit case, and they would conduct a statewide training program for all child protective investigators and supervisors to help identify red flags in high-risk situations. Yet, confusingly, Mike also wrote that the Chieflin DCF office, which was the specific one responsible for the Spirit case, was not overworked and was, in fact, an exemplary performer. But how could it be both? How can a department be held up as the ideal model, but also have failed so spectacularly that they kickstarted a statewide training program? How can you believe they saw these red flags, made the correct call, but also decide they need help identifying red flags? I understand the desire to not want to throw colleagues under the bus, especially those that work under you. But at the same time, a refusal to hold people accountable represents a clear pattern of negligence. The same negligence that was fostered by endemic apathy. This attitude is contagious, and it starts at the top of an organization and works its way down, like poison seeping into the ground soil. And if anyone is an example of how not to take responsibility for their actions, I believe it's the then governor of Florida, Rick Scott.
Investigators inside the Department of Children and Families, the state's top child welfare agency, say Florida is putting children at risk.
I don't know how to manage it. It's virtually impossible.
And they did expect people to pretty much work 24/7.
The people that really care about the families are few and far between.
And it becomes more about numbers and statistics than ensuring that a child is safe.
These three former child protective investigators are just a few of the dozen we talked with. They all believe the department is setting children and investigators up to fail.
Before you cannot feasibly care for all these many families and children, there's no way.
Yeah, a lot of times people wouldn't get interviewed. You know, it's a big deal to lie about those things. Sometimes my supervisor would be like, oh, we'll just say that you couldn't get in touch with him.
That's because they say investigators are handling too many cases at one time.
Madam President.
Senator from Florida.
For years, Republicans fought against wasteful spending under the Obama administration. My party argued that our debt and deficits were unsustainable. Congress spends taxpayer money with no accountability, something you would never do in business or in your personal life. This is not sustainable, and will have dire consequences.
Behind every case is one, two, maybe even 10 children or more.
When you have a caseload of 20, 25, 30, 35, you are bound to not just fail, most likely, but your families that you are charged with overseeing and helping are going to fail.
Madam President, I had the opportunity to pursue the American dream. Unfortunately, the left has worked hard over the last 50 years to discredit the values of the America I want my grandchildren to grow up with.
When you get two or three cases a day, you literally cannot do what you need to do to make sure that you're doing a good job. You can't do it.
And I've had so many families to call me crying on the phone with me, you know, begging for help. And there are times when my supervisor would be like, well, they can deal with it on their own.
The left discredits those who believe in a supreme being or the commitment of marriage and doesn't place family value in family. They want you to think America was never great.
Phoebe Johnchuk. Her father threw her off a bridge. Janiyah Thomas went missing for a year before she was found dead. Chance Walsh had a baby wiped, stuffed down his throat by his dad, a dad who previously lost custody of seven kids.
Even the recent case of Talia Allman, who basically starved to death. The department released a new statement stating that there were missed opportunities. But again, that's the go-to phrase.
Each time, DCF Secretary Mike Carroll says they'll do better.
Today, we have investigators that have well beyond 20 cases or 30 cases, and it begs the question, are there going to be more missed opportunities?
We all acknowledge that Americans, our country, and our institutions have flaws, but the left has worked to discredit our founders, our churches, our law enforcement, our morals, and almost everything my mom taught me.
It's so bad at this point that there are investigators that are resigning left and right.
At least 55 DCF investigators in our area have quit in the last 14 months. And when they leave, their cases get put on someone else.
Is this interview your plea for help?
It is. And it's not just mine. What's going to happen, my fear, is that a child is going to die, unfortunately, and somebody's going to scratch their head and say, how could this have happened? It's inevitable. It's inevitable.
Was left alive there?
Excuse me?
Can you clarify if anyone was left alive at the home?
No, there wasn't.
Can you tell us if the shooter had a gun legally? Did he have a carry, concealed carry permit? Can you tell us anything about his gun ownership?
The answer to that would be no, he was not a legal gun owner.
He was not a legal gun owner.
Okay. That this could happen, anything like this? I mean, I know you guys have been out there several times.
I mean, no, I mean, it's, you know, I don't know. I'm not real sure how you get clear signs that something like this could have happened. I mean, you know, and it's a difficult scene, okay? That's all I'll say. It's to try to fathom why somebody could do what they did. I'll just leave it at that.
I love it when my grandchildren pray before eating, recite the Pledge of Allegiance, ask to visit Military Museum, thank police officers and soldiers for their service, and place their hand over their heart when they hear the national anthem. I hope they memorize the Declaration of Independence and the 23rd Psalm. We will not give up on the American dream.
There is no evidence to suggest that anyone at any time could have known that Don's spirit was capable of this premeditated and intentional massacre. Nancy Dietert, a Republican out of Venice, Florida, said,
"When there's the death of a baby, you want to blame someone, and DCF is the easy target. We can pass all the laws in the world, but the only way you can prevent 100% of deaths is if there's even a whisper of bad parenting, the state takes the kid. And I don't think we're ready for that kind of police state."
I don't think we are either. I don't think anyone envisions a government that has the power to remove children from parents' custody based on a whisper. But in the case of Don Spirit, I believe we have what would be considered by any rational actor much more than a whisper. There's still a gap in our timeline, the years 2001 to 2013, over a decade. And if you think there's enough evidence already, for DCF to have intervened in the Dawnsbeard case, then get ready, because the most violent incidents in Dawnsbeard's past we have yet to cover. And we will in the next episode of Tapes from the Dark Side. Stay tuned till after the credits for a promo from the Weird Distractions podcast and a few updates about Tapes from the Dark Side. Remember to check out our website, tapesfromthedarkside.com and podpage.com. Podpage is a great tool if you're looking for a quick and easy way to make a beautiful podcast website. Use my promo code DARKSIDE, all uppercase, for $20 off any pro plan, yearly or monthly. Once again, that's podpage.com, promo code DARKSIDE. If you are looking for a new podcast host, or you're looking to start a podcast and you need a hosting site for your audio, use the site that I use, pinecast.com, promo code DARKSIDE, all lowercase this time, for 40% off for 4 months. It's actually a really good deal. That's pinecast.com, promo code DARKSIDE. This episode is brought to you by our Patreon members. We are an independent show made possible by your generous pledges. Sign up today for exclusive stickers, bonus episodes, after shows, and more. We have added 20 more spots to the Dark Star tier, and they might not last long, so check them out today at patreon.com/tapesfromthedarkside. If you sign up for 1 year, you get 2 months free. Thank you to our newest $5 Darksiders, Amanda Strom, Amanda Porterfield, Shelly Jones, Camille, Reverie True Crime, Melanie Hart, Rachel Cuthriel, and Maddie. Also, a huge thank you to our Dark Stars. Our top donor at $11 a month is Florida Gallagher. Our second top donors are Emily Warner, Tara Rose, and Greg B. at $10 a month. And the rest of our Dark Stars at $9 a month: Alice Sontimer, Fran, Caitlin Bridges, Anthony Merlacci, Jamie Taylor, Jalen Ulbrich, J.C. LeVay, James Harrington, Brooke Shell, Laura Huggins, Christy Ramshire, Chelsea Perry, Hannah Jasinski, Candace Smith, Melanie Ochoa, Catherine Case, Bryson Bercy, Iza Loya, Heather, and Key Sardi. Keep the show alive and thriving. Go to patreon.com/tapesfromthedarkside. It takes less than 1 minute to sign up, and our tiers start at only $1 per month. As always, a huge thank you to Augusta Trevororum, who created original music for this season. He has released an album on Spotify. Go check him out today. All of his links will be on our full show notes page on Patreon. Thank you to 2600, who has allowed us to use his song as our main theme. Thank you to the Miami Herald, whose sources we used extensively, especially their research from the Innocence Lost Project. And now, two quick pieces of business. We reached 100 patrons last month, which is amazing. I honestly had no idea when I made this show if we would ever get 100 patrons. Now, if you go to Patreon right now, you'll actually see the total number of patrons under 100. I think it's around 96 right now, as of the moment of recording this. But that happens at the beginning of the month. There's always a handful of declined cards or cancellations, which is not a big deal. But since we did hit 100, I want to fulfill my promise and celebrate with you guys. We're going to be doing another giveaway where we will ship out a custom Dark Side mug. We're going to be giving away a few t-shirts and other mugs and stickers and a bunch of cool stuff. So even if you're not a member of the Patreon, you can come and join the giveaway, and we'll do a watch party after. We'll watch To Catch a Predator, I think. Somehow, Chris Hansen has become the unofficial mascot of the show ever since we paid him $50 to do a shout-out on Cameo for us. And To Catch a Predator is free on YouTube, so it would be pretty easy to do a live stream. When you join the Patreon, you get an entry, and each consecutive month that you're a member gets you another entry. We'll take a vote on the date for the giveaway on Patreon, and that will be after the season ends. I think we have maybe two more episodes, so it'll probably be another month or so. But keep an eye on Patreon and your emails for that date. Our second piece of business is the merch shop. The address will be merchfromthedarkside.com. The website is actually live right now, but the promo codes haven't been set out yet, so don't buy anything yet if you're a patron, because you're going to be getting a coupon code for free shipping or 30% off. Shipping is usually $4, so that should get you back a month of your Patreon membership right away. And the t-shirts, I think you'll get around an $8 discount if you are a Dark Star. One last thing I just thought of is that we'll be doing at least one Patreon bonus episode this season, and hoping to get that out to you soon. Lastly, because this episode got a little political, I anticipate we might see some negative reviews coming our way, which tends to happen anytime you mention politics. So if you want to help us out, rate us 5 stars on Apple or Podchaser. If you go to Tapes from the Dark Side, at the top of the page, click the menu with the 3 lines and press leave a review. Or you can just search Tapes from the Dark Side in the Apple Store. All right, that's enough blabbering from me. Please stay tuned right now, because we're going to play you a promo from a show called Weird Distractions. It's a weekly podcast hosted by Christy and Alex. They chat about true crime, but not just true crime. They also do conspiracy theories and the paranormal. It's a nice kind of more laid back show, so I enjoy it. I recommend it to you guys. Here is the promo for that. And remember, go ahead and search and subscribe to them. Give them a shot. Listen to an episode. It's called Weird Distractions. It's available on all the major podcasting apps.
Do you often find that you need a distraction from everyday life?
Do you like true crime, conspiracy theories, paranormal stories, and other weird, dark tales?
Well, tune in and turn up Weird Distractions Podcast, where we, your hosts, Christy
and Alex,
bring you a weird distraction to help you get through the work week.
Every Sunday morning, you can find our show on Apple Podcasts, Anchor, Spotify, Good Pods, and more.
So grab a snack, get comfy,
and make sure to lock those doors.
Need a distraction? We got you.
Go kill yourself. Go sit in the middle of the road and let a car run over you.
A dark side. Yeah, Scott.